Okay, so Michigan winter, late December, cold, cold, cold. They just closed my dorm room for winter break, locking everybody out until January. I'm the very last one to leave. I try to start up my car, cross my fingers. There's the whir, whir, whir before the engine kicks to life. I look at the dash. I'm waiting for a miracle. The Chevette's fuel gauge bobbles right below the E mark. I search the cushions, the back seat, the trunk, under the floor mat, every cranny of the car, hoping to get gas money to drive to my parents' house across the state. I dig through the pockets of three pairs of jeans. Grand total, $1. One stupid dollar. The car sputters. I figure maybe there's 5 more minutes left in the gas tank before the engine goes dead. I drive the entirely empty Ann Arbor streets to the Comerica Bank ATM on University Avenue. I know there's nothing in my account. I know this because I've checked already, but now I check again. The screen declares that in my account sits a grand total of $2. If I could take the $2 out, I would, but that's not even enough to withdraw. I go through every single option. I've gone through every single option. I put my dollar in a bank envelope. I say that I need to make a deposit. I push the envelope into the machine. It asks me how much I'm depositing. And I type in one. I think about it long and hard. Then I type in zero and another zero. Enter. The automatic receipt comes out. Balance, $102. I hit withdraw, $100. Enter. No way is this going to work out. No way. Then there's the glug, 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 glug of the machine spitting out 5 crisp new $20 bills. I shove them in my pocket and I know they're going to get me. I know there's no free money. I know that I'm something akin to a bank robber. But right then, I also know that I have gas money. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, Desperate Measures. Amazing stories from real people pushed to the edge. My name is Glenn Washington, and forget about that little trick. They shut that down about 15 years back, but get ready, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now for our first story, Snap Judgment's Nancy Lopez is going to kick things off in the Republic of Texas.
When Yvonne Jackson gave birth to her youngest son, Cole, everything seemed to be normal.
A friend of mine had came over to see the new baby. We noticed that Cole had some little red dots all over him, kind of almost looked like heat rash. I said, I think I should probably call the pediatrician. For some reason, something's telling me I need to get him in there.
Yvonne took Cole to the hospital, where they ran a few blood tests. She was told to return in a couple of hours, so she dropped off her two older kids at her mother-in-law's.
And as I pulled back into the parking lot, I saw Laura, the nurse practitioner, standing at the door. I thought it was to unlock it, and as soon as I walked up, Dr. Horner said, I mean, it was like simultaneously, she said, Yvonne, I'm going to take you to the office, and Dr. Horner grabbed Cole and just ran down this long hallway. I was a little in shock because at that time, I thought it was a heat rash. You know, I just thought it was going to be something simple. There was never a thought in my head that Cole had this horrible disease.
Yvonne's husband, Joe, was a truck driver. She says Joe was out on the road, and she didn't want to give him the bad news over the phone. So she waited a couple of weeks until he got back.
I had Cole with me. I said, the baby's sick. And he said, well, what do we have to do to get him fixed?
It took 6 months before the doctors were able to give the Jacksons an answer. Turns out, Cole was born with a rare immunodeficiency disease known as Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome.
I was honestly relieved at that point, thinking, well, hey, we know what this is. We're going to get this fixed, and that's that.
But the disease is life-threatening. The immune system is defenseless, and even a cold can be fatal. The doctors told Yvonne and Joe that Cole needed a bone marrow transplant, and he needed one fast. They told him
that he would never see his third birthday, which would have been July. They said that that's the only thing that could save him, that without that, Cole would die.
The problem now was money. The entire procedure cost $250,000, and the Jacksons needed half of that just to get the baby into the hospital. Their other problem, they lost Cole's health insurance when a monthly fee didn't clear their bank account. They had no idea how they were going to come up with all that money. The doctors told them there was another option. They could send hospice in until the baby passed away.
You don't tell a parent that you're going to keep their child as comfortable as possible just because they don't have the money. So you're saying that if I've got tons of money, my child can live. But if I don't have any money, my child needs to die. That shouldn't even have been a question.
They sold everything but their house. They sold Joe's second truck, some trailers and tools. They organized fundraisers. They had bake sales and car washes and rodeos.
We called our senators. We called everyone. I mean, we seriously called everyone that we knew at that time that we thought might be able to help us.
But by the 2-year deadline the doctors had given Yvonne and Joe to get Cole in the hospital, they had only raised $52,000. Then their prayers were answered. When word spread about their cause, an organization stepped up and matched it. Now, with $100,000, the hospital agreed to go ahead with Cole's operation. But they still fell way too short. The hospital told them they still had to pay out the other $150,000.
I would probably say I panicked a little more than Joe because I was worried that, you know, what would happen if we didn't get the money. And I remember one night he just said, I'm going to get it. He said, I'm not going to let him die. And he said, so don't worry. Your worry is to get Cole to the doctor, make sure the kids are good and safe and take care of them, and I'll make sure we get the money to get him well. He said, this is your worry, and I'll take care of the rest because it's my job to take care of y'all.
Joe was on the road 24/7, hauling produce from Colorado back to Texas, then hauling cattle to California and back again. And miraculously enough, he was covering all the family's expenses, Cole's ever-increasing medical bills, plus their mortgage.
I think deep down, maybe I knew that there was some too much money coming in, but I also knew that it was getting the bills paid and we were able to stay at the hospital with Cole.
Cole's transplant failed. As the doctors came up with a different treatment, the medical bills kept racking up, almost $5,000 a month. Joe kept assuring Yvonne that he was taking care of it. And somehow, he was still getting everything paid for. With time, Cole's health got more stable. He lived to see his third birthday and then his fourth. Life seemed to be finally getting a bit easier for the Jacksons. That is, until one morning.
I was trying to get breakfast, get the lunches packed, and get the two kids ready for school. And someone came over a loudspeaker and said, we need everyone in the house to come out with their hands up. I looked out the door and I said, what the heck is this? It went through my head that maybe they were at the wrong house. And so I told April, I said, April, get John and Cole and go get on my bed and don't get off till I come back in the house because, you know, they get a little gun happy or something. I don't want none of y'all to get hurt. So stay in this house no matter what happens. You just stay in this house. I walked out the door with my arms up, like they said. First, they have like all these little red dot lasers on you. So I'm holding my hands up, and then this guy just comes running by, and he like grabs me up like a sack of potatoes and runs me over to the other side of the driveway. He set me down, and this guy said, are you Yvonne Jackson? And I went, yeah. Who's all in the house? And I said, my kids are in the house. So April, Jackson, Cole, and John, I mean, he said their whole names, are the only ones in the house? I said, yes, sir. I said, how did you know? And I'm like trying to ask him, like, how did you know us? What's going on here? They really wasn't talking. They were just, you know, like everybody was, tons of people everywhere. The ATF come to find out, and the DA and all that were there. And he said, we're looking for your husband. We've got a warrant for his arrest. And I said, for what? And then he starts telling me he's been, you know, hauling drugs. What? I said, have you lost your mind? And so I tell the guy, listen, I'm going in to get my kids. And he said, no, you go in there and, you know, we'll shoot you. And I said, well, I guess you're going to have to shoot me because I'm going to go get the kids. They're scared. I've got to go get my kids right now. I just took off for the house.
They didn't shoot. Yvonne rushed to gather up her kids and tried to figure out what to do next. She was told not to return to the house for the rest of the day.
I'm just like so confused at this point and scared and don't know what's going on. And so I actually dropped off my oldest son. I don't know why. I look back now and think I wish I hadn't done that. But I did drop him at school. And then my daughter said, I'm not going, Mom. I'm staying with you because I'm scared. I said, me too. I don't know what's going on. Let's go to Nanny's.
Yvonne spent the day just waiting for night to fall. That's usually when Joe called.
He called me that night, and I said, these people came into the house, and he was like, what? So I told him what happened. He said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. It's okay, don't worry about nothing. It's okay. You know, I knew what had happened, what was going on at that point. He ended up hauling some drugs, and they paid him to do that, and he did it to come up with the money for coal.
For 2 years, Joe was transporting methamphetamine. He would get a grand for every pound of meth he carried from California to Texas. A typical load was up to $11,000 worth of meth, enough to pay for Cole's medical expenses. Joe turned himself in. The federal court in Fort Worth found him guilty of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute methamphetamine. At trial, the defense presented letters and evidence to show that the reason Joe did what he did was because it was his last resort. It was the only way to pay for his son's transplant. But the judge, notorious for his harsh sentences, didn't bat an eye. He sentenced Joe to life.
All right.
Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Sorry about
Joe
that.
Joe has been locked up now for nearly 19 years. He's been moved around a lot and currently finds himself in a low-security federal prison in Arkansas. He gets to talk on the phone 5 hours a month, but only in 15-minute increments. 15 minutes, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
But, you know, if you need more time, we'll have to wait 30 minutes.
Joe's days are pretty much on repeat. He talks with Yvonne and the kids on the phone every week. He works at the prison grocery store, making 75 cents an hour. He gets off at 5. And that's when he calls me one Tuesday. Joe tells me that even after all this time, he clearly remembers what he told the judge when he sentenced him to life.
I said, you know, when that boy right there was dying and we tried every way in the world asking all you people for help, every federal agency there was, you wouldn't help us, and I don't figure you're going to help me now. And that's exactly what I told the judge in my statement at sentencing. I done knew what I was fixing to get, and it was over. My only regret was that he couldn't give me a death sentence. At least if I'd have died, or they'd have put me to death, my family could have got over it and got on with their lives. I hate it that my wife is set out there by herself all these years. She works all day long, goes home to an empty house, you know.
Joe has missed out on a lot. Birthdays and graduations, watching his daughter get married, his grandchildren being born. Joe, when you look back, is this something you'd do again if faced with the same circumstance?
Well, you're asking me if I'd do anything different. I didn't like what I had to do then, and I wouldn't like it if I had to do it now.
Another, this call is from a federal prison.
I'm telling you what. I'm glad that I had that avenue to get big money fast other than, say, walking in a bank with a gun, because I'd have done whatever I had to do. Do you have kids, Miss Lopez?
I don't.
No. You'll understand when you have them, believe me. it's still a blessing to me to have my kids healthy.
Doctors never thought Cole would live past 5, and now he's 24. He has high blood pressure and takes a bunch of pills to boost his immune system, but overall, he's pretty healthy. I talked to Cole, and he says that growing up, it took him a while to understand why his dad did what he did. Now that he's an adult, he gets it. And actually, he can't help but live with some guilt about it.
I know it weighs on him, but I don't want Cole to feel guilty about it. It's not Cole's fault I'm here. I'll tell you, if I'm going to bring a child into this world, then it's my duty to make sure he's got the best chance there is. And if he's sick like mine was, I'm a sorry son of a bitch if I wouldn't give my life to save his.
Thank you, Joan and Vaughn, for sharing your story. I keep thinking that if my kids were in trouble, I might have a cell right next to Joe. And if you're wondering, Joe may be a candidate for a special presidential pardon given to nonviolent drug offenders with clean prison records. We wish you the best, Joe. To learn more about Joe and his family's story, check out reporter Malcolm Garcia's article at GuernicaMag.com. We'll have a link as well at snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Nancy Lopez, with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Now, when Snap Judgment returns, you don't need shoes to crash a plane. And sometimes, nature is not your friend. When Snap Judgment, the Desperate Measures episode continues, stay tuned. Here's something that's going to surprise you. You ready? You should be snacking more. You need to be snacking more, and here's why. NatureBox.com. NatureBox offers hundreds of delicious snacks. Delicious, and you don't have to feel guilty about eating them, because they're better for you. They're natural. With 0% trans fat, 0 high fructose corn syrup, they're low in sugar, non-GMO, and without gluten. And they ship for free. You know that cranky moment around 3 p.m. when you're ready to tear into anything? Rather than go to the vending machines, why don't you grab peanut butter nom noms from Nature Box, or baked sweet potato fries, or dark cocoa almonds? No more hungriness, no more crankiness. Now get ready to be really happy. If you try NatureBox.com right now, you're going to get 50% off your first month's box. Just go to naturebox.com/snap. You should be snacking, but you have to snack smarter. Stay full, stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/snap to get 50% off your first month's box. naturebox.com/snap. naturebox.com/snap.
Thanks for listening to Snap. Want to freshen up your mix of podcasts? Maybe something funny or something brave? Or how about big ideas and time to really sink into them? Okay then, NPR podcasts can help. Browse them all and find some new favorites on iTunes under podcasts.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Desperate Measures episode. Today, we're pushing people's back against the wall. For our next story, we travel to one of America's most beautiful places to discover that, yes, there can even be trouble in paradise.
When you're out here, it's perfect for star watching. There's no lights. You don't see any neighbors. You don't see any other houses. In the middle of this is our tiny 360-square-foot cabin.
Now, you know how writers are, right? They need their space to concentrate. So Bob Fria lives on an island, Orcas Island, and he's got a cabin perched on a cliff overlooking Puget Sound. It's hard to get to, where no one can bother him.
One night, I'm lying in bed asleep, and right around 3 o'clock in the morning, my eyes open up, and it's one of those things where subconsciously, you know something woke you up, but I have no idea what it was. I'm instantly thinking, well, somebody is around here. Somebody is known to be in the area. He's been breaking into neighbors' homes. So I'm not just passing it off that it's a deer.
Yeah, because deer don't break into your house, take your food, your credit cards, your electronics. They also don't clean up after themselves, leaving only a trail of footprints. The neighbors chalked up their worries to some small-time criminal dude. But then,
in the fall, this bizarre thing happens. An airplane is stolen from our little airport on the island. You know, this is something that never happens anywhere.
Whoever took the plane flew it 300 miles before crash landing. When authorities arrive at the crash site, they discover all the fingerprints wiped clean, but the cockpit is covered in vomit. Someone knew how to take off, but wasn't so good at landing. Everybody's stumped. But 5 months later, Orcas Island police find a stolen boat abandoned on the shore.
There's a break-in at our one supermarket we have on the island, and when they pulled the security tapes, here's an image of this guy. He looks kind of young. He's barefoot. That was kind of strange. But that matched because the police were finding bare footprints on like metal roofs of people's homes and things like that. But now we have an image of this guy. So they send it around, and there's a little cooperative of little county sheriff's departments. Bingo. They call us up, and it was kind of like an exterminator telling you, and they said, well, we're afraid you have a Colton Harris Moore problem.
Colton Harris Moore, a.k.a. the Barefoot Bandit. This kid has been on the run since he was 16 and broke out of juvenile detention. And now, somehow, he's taught himself to fly, and he's raiding the island's homes.
You know, we were in this rainbow fantasy land that there's no crime, that you never have to lock your doors. You go to town, you get out of your car, and you leave your keys in the cup holder and the door unlocked, and then you go do your shopping. But now that's all burst. It made me angry.
But apparently in the rainbow fantasy land, they do have shotguns and crossbows. And some folk are taking to the woods on their own vigilante manhunt. And this flurry of community activity, it brings back some memories for Bob.
A lifetime ago, when I was 22, I had spent over a year in the Republic of Maldives with a guy who, at the time, was the number one most wanted fugitive from the United States.
That's right. Before he was a writer, Bob lived in the lamb. You know those people that spend a year abroad to find themselves? Well, Bob, he ran a scuba shop on the Maldives with an older guy who, let's just say, had some trouble with the FBI. That's a whole other story, but when the FBI caught up to his buddy, they had some questions for Bob, too. So Bob did what any sensible scuba guy would do. He disappeared.
So with, you know, the authorities and reporters chasing me, I ran from island to island. I finally wound up sleeping on a beach on what was basically a sandbar in the middle of the Indian Ocean until these people gave up. So on a lot of those nights, when Colton was out there hiding somewhere in the wilderness, I had a little bit of affinity for what he was going through.
So Bob is intrigued with Colton. His neighbors think he's nuts, but he starts writing about it, posting about it on the internet. He tries to talk to people who know the real Colton and finds out about his tough upbringing. Then finally, he gets a break. A woman everyone calls Shotgun Pam agrees to talk. Shotgun Pam Kohler is Colton Harris Moore's mother.
No matter what Colton was about, he had to grow up partially an outcast just because of his mom. He'd invited friends over to the house, and they showed up, and she met one 10-year-old kid at the door with a shotgun in his face.
It turns out that even while he's on the run, Colton Harris Moore somehow talks to his mother, and she's got a surprise for Bob straight from Colton.
Pam told me that Colton had been researching me online and reading my blog.
He's reading your internet-y thingy or whatever the hell she said.
I don't remember ever having a subject, even in crime stories, who instead of you hunting this person, they're kind of looking back at you and trying to figure you out at the same time. So that got my attention.
So, sure, it's easy to Google yourself and see who's writing about you. But Bob gets that same eerie feeling that he had before.
You know, I'm in this tiny cabin on Orcas Island where Colton is somewhere right outside in the woods. So my head's in 8-year-old, 10-year-old Colton thinking about him and the horrible life he's going through. You know, that's when you said, geez, I would adopt, you know, that kid. You know, God, if I knew something like that was going. While at the same time, I've got a shotgun sitting at the door because 18-year-old Colton is somewhere running around with a gun in the woods somewhere near my house.
And then one day, Bob gets an unexpected call from Pam.
Pam told me that the FBI told her that a boat had been stolen from Orcas Island and had never showed up anywhere. So that meant that Colt would be dead. And she said, well, how long does it take for a body to wash up? And, you know, again, being cold Pam Kohler. But when they left, I guess she started thinking about it. And for the first time, she sounded like a mother and she was shaken up. She asked me if there'd been any hide nor hair of him on Orcas Island. It'd been a really quiet time. So she said, do you think you can use your internet thing to try to get word to him, to give me a sign to tell me that he's okay?
So Bob writes a post asking Colton to please send his mom some kind of sign that he's alive.
The next morning I get up, and from where I live, the only place to get anywhere is to drive across this little bridge. And I pull up to the bridge, and the hair on the back of my neck goes flying up because in the middle of the bridge is a 13-foot spray-painted barefoot. A big black foot with 5 little toes on it right in the middle of the bridge. You know, there were a number of times during this when I got, you know, that kind of eerie feeling that somebody's watching you. Of course, when there's a 13-foot barefoot, you know, painted on a bridge, that's a little more obvious than just a feeling. That means, yeah, somebody is paying very close attention. Somebody is reading what you're writing. Somebody knows exactly where you live. You know, it was definitely a message to me.
And then Bob sends him a very public message back. He writes an article for Outside Magazine all about Colton. And almost overnight, the world falls in love with the Barefoot Bandit. The news calls him an outlaw hero, like Jesse James.
He was in the basement of a place he had broken into, and the family came home, and he had a gun, and he pointed it at the homeowner, who, you know, was a real big guy, and he's screaming at him because his kids are screaming and everything else. And it became this hair trigger moment where Colt could have killed him.
Now, Bob feels like he has to tell him to knock it off. He writes,
"We know you could run forever, Colt. The problem with that, though, is exactly that. You'll be running forever, always looking over your shoulder. Now, however, you know you can end this on your terms and have your own dream team lawyer to give you the best defense possible. You've still got choices, and this seems like an easy one." So, you know, there must have been 3 or 4 or 5 or maybe a half dozen times where I kind of reached out to him and said, here's a great opportunity for you to end this in the best way possible. And he totally ignored them. I did hear, you know, I heard from his mother. You know, I said, hey, did he read what I wrote? She's like, yeah, he's not interested. You know, I never had a little brother, but I felt like if he was a little brother, a big brother should come and slap him in the head and say, you know, here's one of those life lessons. Maybe because you're a goofy kid right now, you don't understand it. But at some point, you're going to understand that I was giving you good advice for this.
So now, Colton steals another plane and skims the border of the Vancouver Olympic no-fly zone.
But then the little radar blip disappears over Orcas Island, so he doesn't get a missile up the butt. But instead, he lands on Orcas Island and doesn't run straight for the woods. He goes to a little family-owned market we have, a health food store, and he rips them off and destroys the security system and then spends, it had to be 15, 20 minutes, drawing 39 bare footprints running up and down the aisle of this store. And they lead to the exit door with a little jaunty little "see ya." And when that happened, you know, then, of course, everything explodes and the story is huge and, oh, the fan clubs go up to 100,000 people and all that. But it was at that point that I stopped my blog. Before that point, Colton Harris Moore had always just been Colton Harris Moore. This barefoot bandit thing was nothing. That was a construct. That was this myth. When he did this and drew the footprints, he was taking on that mantle. He was saying, "I am the barefoot bandit." And when that happened to me, the danger ramped up immeasurably. It's the 4th of July, and the headline is Colton Harris Moore steals a plane, which, of course, but then it says where he landed. Colton Harris Moore crash lands a plane in the Bahamas. The Bahamas are like a second home to me.
And now, Colton goes on a tear, robbing every single place that Bob featured in his last travel story about the Bahamas.
He left Orcas, where he was ripping off all my friends and neighbors, leaves the country, goes to a different country, and he's ripping off my friends there.
At this point, Colton's pretty much toying with Bob. Bob books a flight to the Bahamas, to the island of Eleuthera.
So I wind up on Eleuthera, and I'm the only journalist there. You know, it's me and Colton on the island.
He searches high and low, and finally ends up in a place called Preacher's Cave.
I go in there, and the flashlight flickered and then gave out. And then you suddenly realize, as you're in this situation, in this pitch-black cave, what's going to happen if he says hello? You know, or suddenly there's a voice that says, "Hi, Bob."
But Bob is just scaring himself in the dark. Colton is elsewhere, zipping around in a stolen boat. He yells to some locals to call the cops, but he wants to be chased.
The only thing that finally caught the barefoot bandit is that, as lucky as he had been, you know, stealing five planes and crashing five planes living, doing all these, you know, strange waters in the middle of the night. Well, here's the one time when the tide was against him. It was low tide, and everybody who's been up there knows that there is this sandbar that extends from Harbor Island towards Eleuthera. And when it's low tide, you have to make a dog leg around it before you hit open water. Well, Colt went straight and hit the sandbar. Didn't damage the boat. He wasn't stuck forever, but he's, you know, his props are in the sand and he's got to kind of work the boat off it. But it slowed him up enough that the boat with all the cops came up behind him. They knew where the sandbar was. When they got close to the sandbar, they turned on their lights and turned on a spotlight. It was at that point that Colton fired a shot. You know, he had a Walther PPK. Of course, they're all screaming at him now to drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun. He's screaming at them. He goes, get the spotlight off me. I'm not going back to jail. I'll never give up. You can't take me back to jail. I'll kill myself if you come any closer. So they kept coming at him, and he then raises the pistol to his head, and nothing happens. The gun was jammed, so he may have pulled the trigger. You know, we don't know, but whether he did or not, it didn't go off. This was a kid who, through everything I had known, I mean, I felt like I really got to know the kid and, you know, care about him and not want him to end up dead. Him doing that as an act of desperation would have just been tragic. It would have been awful.
Bahamian police arrest Colton. He's tried in a tiny immigration court in order to sneak him back into the U.S. as quickly as possible. Bob is one of the few people who make it inside the courtroom.
I just wanted to look into his face as close as I could possibly be. You know, what was he feeling? Was he beaten? Was he, you know, was he relieved that it was over? Was he depressed? You know, they lead him into prison all shackled, and he's surrounded by these guys dressed in ninja outfits. And he never looked back at, you know, the little gallery where there's 10 of us sitting there. So they go through this little farce of a procedure, and you know, the police are trying to get everybody out of the courtroom. And I'm intently staring at Colton Harris Moore's face, and he'd never looked back. And now a detective comes up, and he's recuffing him. And that was the first time he ever just barely glanced back and looked. And he kind of scans the room and he gets to me and his face instantly lights up. You know, he later told people that he saw me all the time around the island. He does this double take, his eyes pop open, and he just does this huge grin. You know, this big smile. To me, at the time, it was like a gigantic, he's 6'5". It was like a giant version of Dennis the Menace. And I just, you know, just as a reaction, I just smile back, you know. And he kind of laughs, and then the detective yanked his cuffs again, and then so he looked down, and then he looks back at me, and he, again, big smile and kind of this little nod or whatever. It was just, hey, man, that was a hell of a ride.
Thank you, Bob, for sharing your story with the Snap. Now, Colton Harris Moore is currently serving a 7-year prison sentence. When he gets out, he hopes to study aeronautical engineering. To learn more about Colton Harris Moore, check out Bob Friel's comprehensive book, The Barefoot Bandit, True Tales of Colton Harris Moore. That story was produced by Anna Adlerstein with sound design by Leon Morimoto. Now, when Snap returns, we're getting lost, and not in a good way. When the Desperate Measures episode continues, stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Thanks again for listening to Snap. Don't forget to check out all the other NPR podcasts available for free on iTunes.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the Desperate Measures episode. My name is Ben Washington, and today on the show, we're exploring what happens to a person when they feel the walls crashing in. And our next story comes to us from our very own Julia DeWitt. Snap Judgment.
Rain falls outside the window of my hut quarters. I'm 18, in New Zealand alone, working at a national park called Tongariro. I'm at the beginning of a 5-day stretch in the field, and after only an afternoon in my hut, I'm gripped by the panic that I said the wrong thing to Nathan. I had fallen in that kind of love that you can only experience once, usually when you're young. Nathan's another hut warden, built like the rugby player he is, standoffish at first, then hilarious and gentle when you get to know him. The night before, Nathan and I were standing in the kitchen of the warden house. I said something stupid, and I hadn't found the right words to fix it by the time we had to pack our bags and go into the field. The park is where one of the most popular day hikes in New Zealand is. You walk down a long valley in the shadow of a totally vegetationless volcano and then up to a pass where you look down onto 2 turquoise lakes. There are no trees, not even scrub brush, just pumice and 2 milky emerald lakes. Nathan's hut is on one side of the park, and mine is on the other. Sitting in my hut, I wonder, what's he thinking, sitting there alone in his hut? What will he think about me until I see him? I can't stand the idea of him ruminating without knowing I'm sorry. I have to go say I'm sorry. It's 10 p.m. Nathan's hut sits a day's hike away. I have to pass through 3 valleys and up over an exposed pass to get to him. It's a hike I know well. I do it almost every day. Outside, rain falls heavily in the pitch black. The moon and stars are blacked out by the thick cloud cover. But I can do this hike with my eyes closed. It'll be pretty uncomfortable, but I figure it's a small price to pay. So I put on my government-issued rain jacket, shorts, and hiking boots, put a water bottle and my radio in my backpack, and I stepped out into the rain. Odoriri Valley, where my hut is where they wanted to shoot the Mordor scenes in The Lord of the Rings. It's this huge expanse of sand that has these big black volcanic rock formations scattered through it. But in the dark, I can only see about 10 feet in front of me. As I walk up the valley, I pick my way between track poles, these poles with reflectors on them. They're the only way to know where the trail is in the sand. Get to one, scan for the next one, I walk out to it, and so on. As I scan, my light picks up the raindrops that make this kind of shimmering veil that I have to squint through. I'm driven forward from one pole to the next by the image of Nathan in his hut quarters, washing the dishes and thinking about what I said. Sometimes I can be too snarky with people that I love. What if he decides he can't date a girl like that? Who would ever want to date a girl like that? Nathan is a Kiwi, older than me. He barely acknowledged me at first, but then one day he just kind of started talking to me. We sat in the back of a 15-passenger van. He wore this sort of a Lycra hoodie that I would come to know as a staple of his. For the first time, I felt that feeling of crossing over. That feeling when the world beyond each other gets a little bit blurry. It's just you and him and nothing else. As I come up out of the valley, picking my way up a scree slope, I wonder if he's mad or if he's sad. God, what if he's sad? I lose the trail and find it again, lose it and find it all the time, imagining Nathan alone, that intense no-one-else-in-the-world bond slowly breaking. When I crest to the lakes, the wind coming straight from the ocean hits me for the first time. Suddenly, the shimmering raindrops are streaking sideways. There's nothing to block the gusts between me and the ocean 4 hours away. And at the same time, I'm hit with just how bad I must have made Nathan feel. He has to know that it's not him. It's me. I'll tell him when I get there. It's me. Up ahead of me now is just this next part, the hardest part. If I get up and over Red Crater, the place where I will stand the most exposed, I can drop down into the second valley. It's more protected there. I'll know exactly where I am. Red Crater is a beautiful formation in daylight. It's a deep red cirque that you can walk into. The trail takes you up and over the rim. To me, though, there at night, it's just a narrow ridge of deep red gravel, maybe about 10 feet wide, that points my way. I start walking up it, and there is where I feel the fullest force of the wind. I stumble and lean back at it, feeling the wind like some kind of punishment. What kind of person says hurtful things to the people that they love? Not good people, that's who. Bad people. Bad people do. If I just could hold my tongue sometimes, if I just wouldn't get so involved in that one moment. As I walk higher and higher, I can't lean any harder into the wind, and I stumble towards the edge of the crater. I can see the edge, but in my mind's eye, I can see the steep drop-off beyond it, where now there's only black. So I drop to a crawl. Now my light is only a couple feet off the ground, so my vision shrinks to the pumice under me, and my red hands digging into it. I manage to get to the top of the crater, and then to a high gravel field where I can stand. Can't see the trail anywhere. Start getting cold. But I figure if I just keep moving, head across the field, I'll find it on the other side. Just right beyond my light. As I march, I think, you know, maybe Nathan did say something a little bit brash too, but who cares? Was it even that hurtful? Maybe I just projected that onto the situation. Why do I always have to make things so difficult? Who will ever love somebody that makes things so difficult? Probably no one. Yeah, no one. No one would. No one will ever love me because I make it impossible. And I'll just keep getting myself into these messes over and over and over until after a long and loveless life, I finally die. And then suddenly I hear a skittering. It's the rocks under my feet, and I stop. I look ahead of me, and all I see is black. This is not the trail. This is the edge of a cliff. My heart rate quickens, and I turn around immediately, running from the black abyss beyond the drop-off. And then I get this sinking feeling, because if that is not the trail, then where is it? I retrace my steps back. Sometimes hundreds of people sit at this spot during the day, eating their lunches in t-shirts and sunglasses, looking out onto the lakes and the crater down below them. So many people walk here that there's no defined footpath. I turn off my headlamp, hoping my eyes can adjust to the darkness so I can find a familiar, far-off landmark. But all I can see are black silhouettes against a dark, dark gray sky. There's no way to tell the difference between a pile of rocks right in front of me and the volcano that I know looms out there somewhere. Turn my light on, streaking rain. Turn my light off, nothing. Turn my light on, gravel at my feet. Turn my light off, nothing. And then I leave my light off, and I stand there alone in the dark. Maybe for a few seconds, maybe for a few minutes. I think of my soaked-through rain jacket, and I think of my core, which is now chilled through. I think of my backpack, where I have a water bottle and a walkie-talkie. But at the other end of my walkie-talkie, in the middle of the night, I know there's no one there. And then I stop thinking anything. My mind goes totally blank. I just start moving. I find something that looks like a trail. I follow it until it turns into a ravine, and I go back to the field. I find another promising divot. I follow it, and I come to another cliff. I guess and test over and over, every time coming back to the empty, dead field. Then finally, I actually find it. I'm moving as fast as I can, but I'm not getting any warmer. This is when I remember that hypothermia can set in a matter of minutes in the right conditions, especially when you're wet. So when I get to a rock formation, the only cover on this exposed ridge, I crawl into this crack. I pull my knees up to my chest, and I consider waiting out the storm until the morning. Then I realize that I know this crack. It's the same crack where last year a day hiker, like me, sought cover, probably also figuring he'd wait out the storm. A hut warden found his dead body in the morning. I have no idea what time it is, don't know how long I've been hiking or how long it will take to get down, but I know I can't stay here. So I crawl out and do the only thing I can do. I just go. The wind whips up again. I keep getting colder and colder. So when I hit the next valley, I pick up my pace. But as I walk, I start to notice this thick, creamy smoke creeping along the ground. I've never seen anything like it. It's creeping from the edge of where my light shines and rising as I walk. And as it does, the track poles leading me through this empty expanse of sand start to grow larger and larger until they're towering above me. I don't yet understand why, but I do know that I'm hallucinating. I've slowly been losing all sense of time and space. So I start walking faster, understanding now that if the elements don't get me, my mind might. Heading down into the valley below, I'm losing my coordination. When I hit the boardwalk, the final stretch down to Nathan's hut, I start running. My boots are clapping against the wood. And then, as suddenly as I lost sight of my hut back on the other side, I come up on Nathan's hut. I walk up the steps towards his door, but I don't knock on it. I sit on a bench instead, where I finally have time to realize that I almost died. Looking back at it now, years later, I remember that feeling so clearly. What I don't remember is what I was even sorry for that night. I would go on from there to do this many times. I would find myself in situation after situation where I created problems in need of solutions so immediate that it would create real problems. But back then, sitting there staring out into the rain, I had no answer to the question, why did I just do that? If Nathan even was mad at me, he forgot the minute he opened his door and found me sitting there soaking wet looking back at him. After hiking for hours, crawling up a crater, verging on hypothermia to get there, all I could think to say was, hey. Once I was in his quarters, though, my apologies and sorries came pouring out. I didn't even bother taking off my wet clothes. I was so busy blathering that I didn't notice that he was pulling off my wet clothes for me. In fact, I don't think he was even listening. I don't even know if he cared why I did it. Or maybe he was just too busy making me a sandwich and tea and digging out dry clothes to hear me. If I hadn't come that night, if I'd waited even until just the next day, maybe he would have been mad at me for a second, but he still would have kissed me on the cheek, wrapped his arms around me, and that night we would have fallen asleep. He still would have taken me cliff jumping and watched me while I hung out the laundry and cried when I left to go back to the United States. But when we went to bed that night, I stayed awake listening to his breathing and to the wind blow. Every time it did, I shook, and I pressed back into his arms for more safety, wishing he was still awake too. I didn't realize even then that I didn't need to press back further. I could rest there quietly on his shoulder, accepting the warmth coming from his body, and fall asleep too. Then finally, right before daybreak, I did.
That was Snap Judgment's Julia DeWitt. To learn more about Julia DeWitt and her world, listen to Snap Judgment. What? It's that time again? Yes, it is. But you want some more Snap. We understand. Full episodes, the podcast, pictures, stuff, available right now at snapjudgment.org. Subscribe. Interact with Snap Nation on the Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and the most treacherous band of scallywags ever to sail the seven seas. Please point and call him names. The Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. He beats the beats, Pat and C.D. Miller. She who cannot be named, Anna Sussman. She who must be named, Julia DeWitt. That guy was framed, Joe Rosenberg. She's not lame. Nancy Lopez. Davey Kim plays the game. Renzo Gorio dances in the rain. And Jasmine Aguilera brings the pain. Our Snap Crack production crew, Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, Eliza Smith, and Aurora Soria. Will Urbina waits in hiding. Now, did you ever eat half an apple and then put it in the fridge without dabbing it with lemon juice and wrapping it tightly with plastic wrap? Well, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting does not appreciate it at all. But big thanks to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, will exchange your public radio for three magic beans. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago does not WBEZ in Tulsa. They do not WBEZ in Kalamazoo. They WBEZ in Chicago. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you can hide it, hide it, hide it, oh! Hee, 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 and you'd still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.